I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Our guest, Mara Vistendahl, noticed a dramatic gender imbalance while living in and reporting from China. Last year's census revealed that for every 100 baby girls born in that country, there were 118 baby boys. And in one port city, there were 163 boys for every 100 girls under the age of five. Vistendahl said there are similar population trends in other Asian and Central Asian and even Eastern European countries. She writes about this in her new book called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. She says that world full of men leads to more violence, more prostitution, sex trafficking, child brides, and forced marriages. Needless to say, that's a disturbing prediction. Mara Vistendahl is a science journalist and Asia correspondent for Science Magazine and joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. The natural balance is 105 boys to 100 girls. Why is that the natural sex ratio balance?
Well, that's what demographers have observed over time. Even Charles Darwin studied sex ratios, and between 104 to 106, that's kind of the range that all human populations have shown. We don't really know why that is, but what we do know is it tends to even out. So by the time most kids reach adulthood, the ratio is about even. So it's about 1 to 1.
Which says that along the way, boys die.
That's right. Boys die at faster rates and earlier than girls.
And you have been based in China. When did you literally notice this imbalance in that country?
Well, it's something that's there in the background. The sex ratio imbalance is an issue that crops up in the news again and again. I mean, every time you have a new survey that shows that these kind of wildly out of whack numbers, it's reported in the Chinese press, it's reported in the foreign press.
Can you see it on the street?
You can in certain cities, especially in certain parts of the country. You can't see it so much in cities like Beijing and Shanghai anymore. But if you go to these kind of booming second and third tier cities, these cities that are developing very quickly, industrializing, they're mostly along the eastern coast of China. And if you visit an elementary school, for example, you can just see many more boys than girls in a classroom. And in a few reporting trips where I went into schools and saw that, I was just struck by this kind of trend that's happening.
Is this because of China's one-child policy, or is there something more than that?
Well, that's the explanation that's often given, but it really does go beyond that, because if you look beyond China, you also countries like India, Vietnam, Taiwan, South Korea, the Caucasus countries, Armenia, Azerbaijan, Georgia, and then now recently in Albania, and some speculation that other parts of the Balkans have these imbalances as well. So the one-child policy is part of the story, but it really doesn't give the whole picture.
In fact, you say it has to do with several things. One is reproductive trends, the fact that we can have machines, you know, that literally look in. If a woman is pregnant, she can get all sorts of information about her developing fetus.
No, that's right. So new technologies have come into Asian countries and into Eastern Europe as these countries have developed. So it's been since the early 1980s that women have been able to determine the sex of their fetus in the second trimester and have an abortion if the fetus turns out to be female. But the other trend is that birth rates have fallen across the developing world. So in China, this happened with the one-child policy. But also in India, birth rates have fallen. In South Korea, the average woman had 6 children in 1950, I believe it was, and now she has about 1.1 over her lifetime. So it's a remarkable drop. And when there's that pressure to have a son existing, and then suddenly woman's having fewer children, you can't really guarantee that one of them's a boy unless you turn to technology.
Well, you go so far as to blame the World Bank, the International Planned Parenthood Federation, the Rockefeller Foundation for promoting some of these contraceptive methods, and that have, in a sense, as you say, resulted in the disappearance of 160 million women in East Asia.
Well, the sex ratio imbalance has been it's been typically portrayed as an Asian problem, as a something that happens in distant countries. And what I found when I looked into it is that there is a more complicated story that traces back to U.S. organizations. It goes, I mean, with the International Planned Parenthood Federation, the story goes back to the 1960s and to the ideology of population control that had taken hold at the time in the U.S. It's an old story, but we did play a role.
And when you talk about population control, are you talking though about abortions? Or are you talking about contraception, or the mix of the two of them?
Well, at the time, really, there were all sorts of strategies that were on the table. So population growth was a major issue with good reason to some degree. But there was a kind of, you know, to some degree, hysteria that took hold at the time. And, everything from forced sterilizations to incentivized abortions, And two much milder strategies like birth control were on the table. But one thing that was put forth in the 1960s was actually sex selection as a method of controlling the population. So the reasoning there was that organizations like the Population Council, which was a population research organization, like Planned Parenthood, had done research showing that one of the reasons that couples in the developing world continued to have kids was that they wanted a boy. So then the thinking was, well, why not guarantee them a son on the first try? So this was seen as a solution to the population problem that was voluntary. You wouldn't have to force people to do it. It was something that parents would take up on their own. That's proven to be the case. This is something that tens of millions of parents have chosen to do.
Even in developing countries where people are poor, they have access to information about the sex of their fetus, their baby?
Definitely. This is something that comes in with development. The more women start giving birth in hospitals, more start going to clinics, start getting ultrasound scans. But certainly across China and India, ultrasound is readily available now in rural areas. I mean, there are handheld ultrasound machines. There are technicians that go around with machines kind of on the back of trucks. And unfortunately, the machines are now seen almost exclusively as a way to determine sex. So there are all these other advantages, of course, to ultrasound that we monitor fetal health, advantages for maternal health. But unfortunately, they're just seen as this kind of tool for ensuring boys.
But do you see this machine, in a sense, coming up against a tradition and perhaps even a belief that boys are better than girls, that a family wants to have a boy, and given this choice, this is what they choose? And it's part of a tradition, a belief system.
Well, the belief is definitely there. I mean, if people didn't want boys, certainly we wouldn't have this problem. If there wasn't a preference for sons in the developing world and in other parts of the world too, we wouldn't have more boys than girls. But the technology really needs to be discussed, and the technology is what makes this possible. And it's today it's abortion and it's ultrasound, but we are moving into an era where we can select for sex during in vitro fertilization. And this is a technology that was pioneered in the U.S. in part. It's called pre-implantation genetic diagnosis, or PGD. You can use it to screen the sex of embryos. And that's the direction that we're headed. And so this kind of trend of selection is something that we really need to discuss.
Do you think people, couples, individuals in this country are doing this sex selection that you've seen in other parts of the world?
Oh, definitely, sex selection's happening in the United States. Definitely, if you look at the overall population, we don't have an imbalanced sex ratio at birth, but the fertility industry is a booming industry in the United States. 1% of babies now born through IVF. And these clinics are offering sex selection via PGD as an add-on to IVF. And there are parents that are doing it. There are parents who aren't even infertile, who don't have other reasons to go through IVF, who choose to do it for sex selection in the U.S.
What is the... I guess the solution or the option to this, and one of the things that you write about, or you seem to support, but let me run it by you to see if you do or not, the idea that when a couple or an individual learns the sex of their baby, their fetus, that they not be given that information. Is that something that you think should be done in order to prevent the kind of sex selection that's going on?
Well, this
to withhold that information?
This is already the law in China and India. So both countries, and also South Korea until recently, have outlawed sex determination.
Does it work?
No, unfortunately, it's not very well enforced. So it doesn't work, but I would say that there's not a huge effort to enforce the law. There are activists in Asia who say, let's focus on enforcing that law. I do think that if we are going to if we are going to address sex selection, this is one of the options that needs to be explored. It's one I think parents in the U.S. wouldn't go for, but we need to start talking about the technology because it just continues to move forward.
But do you think that should be a policy, a law in the United States? That parents not be told about the sex of their baby?
Not at this time, no. I mean, I'm more focused on the kind of tragedy that's taking hold in the developing world and the fact that there are 160 million women missing from the population in Asia. I think we need to start looking at that. And what's unfortunate about that is that there's almost no international attention on the issue. There's been a bit of action recently in the past few months, but when you compare it with other major international issues like HIV and AIDS, or even female genital mutilation, which is proportionally affecting a much smaller group of people, there's almost no attention to it, and I think we need to start talking about the gender imbalance and supporting the countries in Asia that are trying to address this.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation with our guest, Mara Vistendahl, and we are talking about her new book. It's called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. She's a science journalist, in fact, an Asia correspondent for Science Magazine, and she joins us, obviously, here on Radio Times to talk about some of what she has observed and some of her concerns as well. She's speaking at the University of Pennsylvania at 11:30 this morning and at Swarthmore College, her alma mater, at 4:30 this afternoon. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, PDA, presenting The Way, starring Martin Sheen. About a father's experience hiking the Camino de Santiago to honor his son. In theaters Friday. Info at theway-themovie.com.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY. Early breast cancer detection means better outcomes. The Women's Cancer Center at Fox Chase offers a full array of risk assessment and screening options, including genetic counseling. From October 20th through the 30th, the PA Breast Cancer Coalition's traveling photo exhibit, 67 Women, 67 Counties, Facing Breast Cancer in Pennsylvania, is on display for public viewing. More at foxchase.org. Fox Chase Cancer Center. Hearts plus minds.
You ask for it. We listened. WHYY-FM is trying something new. YStream, pledge-free streaming radio. Listen without membership breaks on your desktop, laptop, iPhone, or iPad. Visit WHYY.org by October 12th, make a $60 pledge, and enjoy WHYY-FM without membership breaks during our entire October fundraising campaign. For more information on YStream, WHYY's new pledge-free stream, visit WHYY.org.
Academic Urology is pleased to support WHYY. bringing together 36 Philadelphia-area urologists. Academic Urology serves patients throughout the region and at 18 area hospitals. More information online at academicurology.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. The normal sex ratio for human births is 105 boys to 100 girls, but in some parts of the world, that balance is askew. In China, it's 118 boys for every 100 girls, and our guest Mara Vissendahl has been investigating the causes and implications for this imbalance, and she's written about it in her new book called Unnatural Selection. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And I have to say this world full of men is a rather dystopian picture that you have painted for us. But let's break it down. One is more violence, and are you seeing that in some of these countries where there is this population or this sex ratio imbalance?
Well, the bulk of these, demographers actually call the extra boys surplus. It's a bit of a crass term, and it's hard to say who's really surplus, but the bulk of these boys who don't have a female counterpart are still young. We're kind of coming into this era where they're becoming men, and by 2020, 15% of men in China will be surplus, and 15% of men in Northwest India as well. So to some degree, we're just sort of starting to see what's happening. There are kind of anecdotal reports mm-hmm. of rises in social instability in Northwest India, also sex crimes. There's been one study that showed that crime rates have gone up if you look at provinces in China where the sex ratio is more skewed. Certainly if you look at historical cases, that there is cause for concern. And I think both the Chinese and Indian governments are worried about mm. this.
You also talk about, and I guess what one can see, the connection between a surplus of men, as you say, and things like prostitution. I mean, a man, in a sense, looking for a woman and finding that there aren't enough women for a man.
That's right. Well, the U.S. Department of State report on trafficking in persons that just came out in June cited the sex ratio imbalance in China as a cause of trafficking in and around the region, and some of that's being done for sex work. Mm-hmm. And I featured a story in my book of a girl, a young 15-year-old Vietnamese girl who'd been kidnapped from off the street in Hanoi and shuttled across the border to China, made to work in a brothel. I mean, these sort of cases, they've happened for years, but they are picking up, and international organizations are starting to say that the gender imbalance is a major contributor.
Do you see a connection also to child brides, the idea of a woman getting married or being married off at a younger and younger age?
Well, certainly there's an increase in bride buying men buying brides from other areas, so either poorer parts of their own country, and just it's paradoxically, sex selection is something that's happening more among the upper and middle classes across Asia. So it's wealthier families, mm-hmm. and but when those boys grow up, they have a bit more money, and then can then buy women from other areas. Unfortunately, and there's also women being bought from Southeast Asia, from Vietnam in particular, and many of them are young, many teenagers, I would say, typically, not necessarily younger than that, but it is a sad industry.
How do you suggest, though, I guess, rebalancing this imbalance that you write about? How do you intervene? I mean, we're talking about people's personal decisions. In some cases, it's choice. In some cases, it's coercion. How do we address this problem?
Yeah, it's a complicated. The solution is going to be complicated, and I think needs to be multifaceted. Certainly, we first of all need to take into account the fact that this is something that middle to upper class people are doing. So there have been programs to pay people to have girls across Asia, and I would say that by and large those haven't worked so well. In part because if you're upper class family in Delhi, a payment of of, you know, a few hundred dollars is probably not going to make a huge difference and not going to, you know, sway you one way or the other when you're deciding what child to have. There have been initiatives introduced that do, I think, get at more what elites might be thinking about. So the University of Bangalore this year introduced affirmative action for daughters who don't have brothers. So you can assume that no sex selection was going on in that case. And that, I think, is a strategy that has a chance of working a bit better.
Why would elites or even upper-class people who, they have money, they have connections, they have access, why would they prefer a boy over a girl? What's the advantage for them?
Well, there's so many different reasons why people want boys. But what for me is interesting is that it is elites that are selecting across the world, and it's also elites in the U.S. who are going in for sex selection. We talked about the fact that people who have fewer children who tend to select, and it tends to be elite, upper class people who have only one or two kids now. But I think it goes beyond that. We're really moving into this era of control over reproduction and consumer eugenics. So in the 60s, when population control was on the agenda and there was all this discussion about kind of population in the abstract, it was an era of state control, of top-down strategies. And now we're at the point where individual parents are making these decisions. And when you add up those decisions, you get a huge problem.
In doing research for this book, and it's gotten some very interesting reaction, and there seem to be abortion opponents who have latched on to your idea and have used this as an argument against abortion and against, in a sense, a woman's or in certain cases a family's right to choose abortion. Is that where you want to go?
No, that's not where I want to go. It's sadly, that's where the debate often goes in the U.S. I've done interviews around the world and talked to people and talked to the press in other countries has focused really more on the central issue, which is the fact that we have tens of millions of women missing from the population. I mean, this is a fundamental discrimination going on. For me, as I said, the technology keeps moving forward. Mm-hmm. So if we just focus on abortion, we're going to ignore what comes after it and ignore this issue of selection and whether we should have control over what children we have.
But I can understand how people could see this and take this in a number of different directions. But it does raise questions about choice and what individual choice people have about terminating a pregnancy or not.
Definitely. I do think that the abortion debate can no longer be framed around this notion of choice, that it's a bit outdated for us now. And I think there are actually a lot of reproductive rights groups that recognize this because we're in an era where choice now encompasses this whole range of consumer decisions. Mm-hmm. And so the choice that says, well, I don't want to have, I want to have an abortion because I can't have this child now because I'm, because I'm poor, because I can't give a child a loving home. That's different from a choice that says, I don't want to have this child because this child's a girl or because, I want to have this child if this child has blue eyes, if this child is tall. That's a distinction that we need to make. And the word choice as in a kind of all-encompassing framework doesn't work.
Do you think, though, that if a woman is pregnant with a girl, that she should either not be allowed to have an abortion or she should go through more hoops than somebody else?
No, but it is important to recognize that there is a very different context surrounding abortion in Asia, in part because of the because of the intervention of U.S. organizations, and because of the, and unfortunately, abortion was used as a population control strategy. And so the fact today, abortion rates are quite high in China. They're quite high in the Caucasus countries, in Albania, in most of the countries where we find a lot of sex-selective abortion. That's a legacy of population control, and we need to address that complexity as well. It's very different from the U.S., where we have a ton of restrictions on abortion already.
And that's Mara Vissendahl, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about her new book. It's called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. Let me get some callers in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, it looks like Larry from Indiana to join our conversation. And Larry, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Could I ask a favor? I'm sure I'm not the only older and hard of hearing person. Could you, Mara, would you spell your last name?
Go ahead, Mara.
It's H-V-I-S-T-E-N-D-A-H-L. The H is silent.
H-V-I-S?
H-V-I-S-T-E-N-D-A-H-L. Okay.
Thank you very much. I have a friend who is looking for your book. Is it widely available?
I hope so. I hope so.
Yeah, I mean,
he should be able to find it. Yeah,
it's in standard bookstores.
Okay. It is in standard bookstores.
And Larry, was that your question?
No.
Okay, go ahead with your question.
A salute to Radio Times and a salute to you, Mara. I'm a 69-year-old former radical troublemaker, social protester, etc., and I'm a father and a grandfather. And this, to me, is hands down the most outrageous. I will call it social evil that I can think of in, you know, probably since the Holocaust of World War II.
Well, Larry,
I want to know, Mara, you're deeply involved. You know, you're doing a magnificent piece of work here that's going to be, you know, I'm not, your goal isn't to earn a place in history, but if my perspective on it is anything close to the mark in historical terms, what you're doing is astonishing.
Well, Larry, let me take your point, because we had a lot of callers, and hold on one second, because one of the words that's been used to describe what you're talking about is gendercide. Larry used the word Holocaust. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you see this as gendercide? With all that word means?
What's happening is a huge tragedy. I don't use words like gendercide, feticide. Female feticide is one that's used even in India commonly by people who support reproductive rights. Those are words that have been embraced by the anti-abortion movement, mm-hmm. and I think with the motive there is to kind of set a precedence for a fetus being a life and for abortion being killing. So there is a sort of devastation happening, but it's a quiet devastation. It's the fact that women are missing, that they were not born, and not that they were killed. It's a difficult thing to describe. I actually struggled a lot with the semantics of
sure,
it.
Sure, sure.
Yeah.
All right. Let me get, looks like Tara from Newtown to join our conversation. And Tara, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
Good morning.
Morning.
What I'm wondering is if there's anything that you might see amid all the sorrow and the possible negative social outcomes is anything positive. Back when we first read about that these abortion selections were taking place, and I thought, well, this is going to come back to them. And now we're reading about it, and The Economist did a huge article not too long ago. You know, the chickens have come home to roost, as it were. But then I keep hoping, is there something positive to be seen in it? And Amar, I'm wondering if you've seen anything in terms of the status of women and the expectation, for example, who looks after the parents when they're old, or who is valued. And do you think in the end they might come to say, hey, you know, actually they are important members of society. We need them. We value them more than they have been historically.
Well, Tara, let me find out if there is or is an evolving attitude like that. Go ahead, Mara.
Well, there have been people who've, economists in particular, like to propose this idea that as women become scarce, their value goes up, that it's a sort of simple supply and demand relationship. And by and large, it hasn't happened. I mean, unfortunately, the result has been that women are more at risk as a result of being scarce. That first of all, fewer are being born. Second, for those who are born, they're at risk of being trafficked, of being bought and sold. There have been positive changes for some women, and this is actually happening at a time when women, in many ways, women have more opportunities than ever before in Asia. There are cases of women of being married without dowry in India because they're scarce now in Northwest India. Hmm. So that's one positive thing that sociologists see. I think for some gay men who may not be pressured into marriage as much, that this would be maybe a positive thing. But by and large, the story is one of women being more at risk, and that's something we have to talk about.
And I don't see how you sort of close the door on technology and ultrasound. I mean, it seems to me this stuff is here to stay. It's going to evolve and develop. We're going to know even more about, you know, a developing baby than we probably know today. So if that's true and that sort of, you know, allows people to make these choices, you can't shut the door on this technology, even if you'd want to, it seems to me.
No, but we can regulate technology. I'm not suggesting we should introduce more regulations in ultrasound now, but PGD, this sex selection that happens during IVF, that can be regulated, and the U.S. has incredibly lenient or next to no regulations on this technology. And if you compare us with the rest of the Western world, we are the Wild West. Mm. And that's sex selection during in vitro fertilization is illegal in most Western countries. And so that's something that we can regulate before it becomes widespread. And unfortunately, clinics offering PGD are already spreading throughout the developing world.
Well, we're almost out of time here, but some states have passed laws. I believe Pennsylvania is one of them to outlaw, in a sense, sex selection. Do you favor that? You support that idea?
Not in the way that the laws have been passed in the U.S. I mean, I think we would need to go. We would need to go really if we want to address sex selection and say what China and India have done, which is to say, well, sex determination is going to be illegal as well. And unfortunately, I think the U.S. laws are often sort of targeted at restricting abortion.
Well, on that note, much more to talk about. Mara Vissendahl, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And the book is called Unnatural Selection, Choosing Boys Over Girls and the Consequences of a World Full of Men. She's speaking at the University of Pennsylvania at 11:30 this morning, and then she'll be at Swarthmore College, her alma mater, at 4:30 this afternoon. Coming up, we remember Steve Jobs, who died yesterday. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
AS1812 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. AS1812 Productions presents Mistakes Were Made, the newest comedy from Craig Wright, writer for 6 Feet Under and United States of Tara. Starring Barrymore Award winner Scott Greer, this fast-paced comedy shows us an afternoon in the life of a Broadway producer who turns the theater world on its ear when he decides to make art instead of money. Mistakes Were Made, now on stage through October 30th. Tickets at 1812productions.org.
We want it to be loose, because anything can happen. We don't rehearse, you know. We have to believe in what the other guy's going to do and make it work.
On Canvas, in the Pocket Band.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY TV.
Support for WHYY comes from Westtown School. Since 1799, Westtown has invited students pre-K through 12th grade to pursue a global education, one that helps prepare them not only for college and career, but also for life. Parents who want challenging academics and character development for their child can learn more by attending Westtown's lower and middle school open house Monday, October 10th at 8:30 a.m. Details at westtown.edu.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. You're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Well, as you probably know by now, Steve Jobs, the co-founder of Apple, died yesterday at the age of 56. He had been battling pancreatic cancer for some 7 years. Designer, innovator, and visionary, he transformed the personal computer and the culture along with it. We asked Peter Rojas to join us on Radio Times to talk about Steve Jobs and his legacy. Peter is founder of GDGT.com or Gadget.com, a website that users can review, where users can review gadgets and ask questions. He's also the founder of Engadget and Gizmodo. And Peter, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times. Do we have Peter? Peter, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. That was a nice pregnant pause there. No, not a problem. And also to our listeners, we had a very lively or have been having a very lively conversation on our Facebook page. Do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Peter, I mean, everyone's talking about Steve Jobs and you know, there are lots of cliches and also lots of very powerful words used to describe what he did for the personal computer. What do you see as his single cardinal achievement?
Well, I mean, I think he really brought a humanism to computing. And if you think about where computers were when he started in the 70s and in the mid-70s, there were these very technical, sort of impenetrable devices which the average person would have no hope of ever using. And he really had this idea that a computer should be something that everyone should be able to use, and that he wanted to democratize computing and sort of put people at the center of computing, and so have computers conform to the way that we are rather than have us conform to our devices. And I think that is really his signature achievement.
Okay, you know, Peter, we're going to try to get you on a better phone here because, I mean, here we are talking about Steve Jobs and computers and technology, and we can hardly hear what you have to say. So we're going to call you right back. But again, I do want to open up the lines to our listeners at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. We are talking about Steve Jobs, who co-founded Apple and died yesterday at the age of 56. President Obama said something very interesting, and I think this underscores what a lot of people are saying about Steve Jobs. This is the president. Steve was among the greatest of American innovators, brave enough to think differently, bold enough to believe he could change the world, and talented enough to do it. By building one of the planet's most successful companies from his garage, he exemplified the spirit of American ingenuity. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be talking about what he was able to accomplish. And, Peter, let me see if we have you on a better line.
Okay, is this a little better?
Oh, that is so much better. We could barely hear you.
Okay.
That's okay. But you were talking about how he essentially humanized technology for us.
Yeah, I mean, I think what he did is he really said that, you know, computers should conform to us rather than us conforming to the computer, that it should be about making them easy to use, something that anyone can pick up and figure out, rather than computers being these really technical, complex tools that only experts would know how to use.
And I wonder if you go from, you know, the Apple II and you include the mouse, Macintosh, iTunes, iPod, iPad, smartphones, can you connect the dots there as you see all the things that he had his fingerprints all over?
Yeah, I mean, I think what it is he's always taking advantage of the latest developments in the technology to be able to make the device easier to use, more intuitive, you know, to sort of make sure that, you know, that the device is always, you know, sort of making sure that whatever you want to do, you can do it in as few steps as possible and as intuitively as possible. And, you know, I think that the things that he, you know, like the iPad and iPhone, were things that he couldn't have done 25, 30 years ago, but he was always really pushing the limits and seeing where the technology was going and was going to go. So so that he was always designing devices to take advantage of the latest technology.
And he seemed to have such a passion for style and design. I mean, really the marriage of technology and things that look a certain way.
Well, I think what is really great about his legacy is that he really had this idea that at the end of the day, design is really the differentiator for this stuff, that on some level, the chips and the memory and the hard drives are all commodities. It's really about how you put them all together and have them work together with the software that creates a great experience. And he was really about creating great experiences, and the devices were almost secondary to that. When he would do a keynote introducing a new Apple product, he spent very little time focusing on the technical specs and the speed of the processor and the size of the hard drive and those sorts of things. And he really focused on the kinds of experiences that it enabled you to do.
But he seemed like such a salesman at heart. And I'm thinking about all those, you know, dramatic unveiling of new products and thinking of the unveiling of these products in theatrical terms.
Yeah, I mean, I've covered many Steve Jobs keynotes, and they're always really exciting, and you always sort of waited for the end where he would do just one more thing, and sometimes he would pull an iPod Nano out of his pocket and wow everyone with something that you didn't see was coming, and he really understood like the power of making that impact. And I think the other thing is he believed so strongly in his products and what they were and what they could be that he really wanted everyone to share that enthusiasm for them. And it was very powerful.
And again, lines open at 1-888-477-9499. We are talking with Peter Rojas about the death of Steve Jobs, yesterday co-founder of Apple, and he died at the age of 56. He had been battling pancreatic cancer for about 7 years and actually gave up his job about 6 weeks ago. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Peter, a lot of people are playing sections from a commencement speech that Steve Jobs gave at Stanford. This was back in 2005. The part that really jumped out at me was his interest in calligraphy. And he talks about how he, at Reed College, a college he actually dropped out of, but how he took a course in calligraphy and how he used that in designing and this first Macintosh computer that, of course, set the world on fire.
Yeah, I mean, I think it shows his attention to those little details and that having to learn about fonts and about how text appears on a screen, those were things that were sort of secondary matters and considerations for most people when they were building computers and computer software. And he said, those things matter, that the font actually has an effect on how you experience the text and how you experience using the computer. And if that's the case, then you have to spend time on those little details. And I think that, kind of cuts across all of, the products that Apple's put out, where there's such a focus on the fit and the finish of the product, the way that you transition from one screen to the next. There's sort of small details that, you don't always think about, but when they're missing and you use somebody else's software or somebody else's product, you really notice that, like, things don't hang together. There's not that sort of holisticness to the product. And you really focus on the little things, almost to a degree where of self-parody sometimes, where you call people up in the middle of the night and complain about the gradient on a logo or something like that.
Well, and I was reading about that he was, I'm not sure what the word is, but he was a tough guy to work for in that he didn't hold back in his criticisms.
No, he could be extremely, extremely brutal. And I've heard stories about people that would deliberately bring him two things they knew were bad so that he would savage them and get it out of his system, and then they would show him the one really good thing. And that he would, sort of be really excited about that. And he was he set very high standards for himself and for his company. And I think that, he didn't suffer fools. I mean, he really didn't feel like he had any time to waste on people that weren't going to give, 100% and really go that extra mile to, focus on those little things and to create great work. I mean, that was really his, the obsession was creating, great work that was going to blow everyone away. And he didn't want to get up on stage and introduce a new product and be embarrassed. And so he would not put something out rather than put something out unless he was completely 100% proud of it.
Peter, do you think there were any missteps?
Oh, I mean, there are always missteps. I mean, you know, he put out the Cube Mac, you know, a little while ago. People might not remember it, but it didn't sell very well. You know, there have been various products over the years that haven't done very well, like their Ping service for music, which hasn't gotten much traction. So, you know, what, you know, and then going even further back, I mean, he was fired from Apple and then had to sort of start over. And I think that, you know, what he has been really good at is learning from his mistakes and from his failures. And I think what even, you know, is sort of, you know, the sort of overarching thing is in Silicon Valley, it's okay to fail as long as you learn from those failures and sort of pick yourself back up and, you know, do something great, you know, learn something and try to produce something great out of that failure. And it's that sort of culture that, you know, he came out of, which is it's okay to fail. What's not okay is to not, like, you know, learn from those mistakes and then try to make something great from them.
Let me get some callers in on the conversation. Looks like we have Beth from Bethlehem to join us on Radio Times. And Beth, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, just a comment about what Steve has meant to our family. I'm a mom, first of all, of two teenagers, and I introduced them to popular music through giving them their first iPods. Hmm. And at this point in their lives, you know, it's really a way for us to communicate that I certainly didn't communicate with my parents over popular music. And, you know, we're always trading songs back and forth and looking at each other's libraries and showing each other what we found. It's just a way for us to connect on a daily basis that he has facilitated. And also, I have to mention, let's not forget Pixar. Come on. Toy Story, everything that's part of our, you know, our family's cultural knowledge, how much has he touched? I mean, from Pixar, Toy Story on forward, think about the movies that he was directly or indirectly responsible for.
Well, fair.
It's just a stunning thing, and we'll miss him.
Well, Beth, I appreciate your call to Radio Times. Let me give Peter Rojas a chance to weigh in on that. Peter?
Oh, I mean, Pixar is, I mean, you know, someone who had just done Pixar would be a hero in a lot of people's eyes, but Pixar's like the second most important thing he's built, right? I think, you know, it's something that he took over and bought after he was fired from Apple and, you know, said, I really believe in, like, you know, the way that computers can create, it was like his idea that computers could create works of art and feature-length films, and he really believed in that vision and invested in it, and it's been wildly successful, and I think that you can see you know, his sort of ethos, you know, permeating what, you know, they do at Pixar still today.
Beth, thanks for the call. Let's see what Alex from Mount Laurel has to say. Alex, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
You know, I think that this man is a great American. He was a great American. He was an innovator and a visionary, as you just mentioned. And we need more men and women like him to help this country turn around to be the country we used to be.
Well, Alex, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And Peter, we should say that Apple is a wildly profitable and successful company.
Yes. Oh, I mean, it's one of the most valuable companies ever created. The company has $80 billion in cash in its bank account, which is actually a function of Steve wanting Apple to have enough money to be able to survive mistakes and to be able to never have to go through that near-death experience it had after he left. Mm-hmm. And it's a testament to, you know, the innovation that he's really driven. And really, I mean, in some respects, the greatest thing he's ever created is Apple itself, which is a company which, you know, I don't think anyone doubts that it's going to continue to innovate and create outstanding products for years to come, even, you know, now that he's gone.
Well, and your voice is going in and out, but we're going to hang in there because we have just a couple minutes before we have to say goodbye. But there is a new CEO, Tim Cook, and this week they actually unveiled the iPhone 4S. How would you assess that, Peter?
Well, I think the iPhone 4S is it's sort of an evolutionary update to the last iPhone 4, which came out last year. The most interesting thing, because the hardware is basically the same with an improved processor, but what's most interesting about it is the voice control technology that's built into the phone, and it's sort of another extension of Jobs' vision of the phone being something that is very natural and easy to use, and that can be controlled entirely through, you know, voice commands. So you say something like, schedule lunch next Tuesday with my dad, and wow, it puts that on your calendar and sets that up. And I think that is sort of driving his vision of that the computer should be able to, again, to conform to the way that you want to do things rather than you having to figure out some code or way of working with it.
He also created a cadre of, they're often called, you're probably one of them, Peter, you know, first adopters. I mean, people that are just, that just salivate over the, some of this new technology. They can be highly opinionated and highly critical.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the standards are very high, and there were people that were disappointed that they didn't introduce an iPhone 5 on Tuesday, that the iPhone 4S is more of an incremental update. But I think that sort of speaks to the high standards and expectations that people have for Apple now. And I think that, you know, I was thinking about this earlier is, you know, it like Steve Jobs is being mourned like the death of a rock star. I mean, it's at a level that, you know, it's hard to imagine, you know, 30 years ago, us talking about someone making computers touching so many people's lives so personally in such an emotional way. And I think, again, it sort of speaks to how he approached this stuff and how computing and technology has really, you know, moved away from just being tools that we use to really being sort of embedded in our emotional lives.
And we're almost out of time here, and this is looking into the future. I mean, Steve Jobs had already resigned from his position at Apple, but can Apple continue, in a sense, literally without him?
I mean, they are going to, and there are you know, a lot of really talented people at the company. I think that the challenge for them is they're going to have to, you know, not fall into the trap of always saying, well, what would Steve do? Because, you know, the last thing he would want is the company to sort of be mired in the past or to always be looking backwards at what he might have done. But, you know, they need to forge their own path and they need to take risks and they need to be able to, you know, look at the future and what's coming and sort of, you know, Tim and his team make their own decisions. And, you know, it's a scary thing, but, you know, Steve built a great team and there's no reason why they can't continue on this path, you know, indefinitely.
Well, Peter, thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're welcome. That's Peter Rojas, founder of GDGD.com or Gadget.com. It's a website where users can review gadgets and ask questions. He's also the founder of Engadget and Gizmodo, joining us today on Radio Times to talk about the death of Apple's Steve Jobs. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times.